Piece of paper you've given on the way in has an outline of our time together. It's really good to see you here this lunchtime. Thank you for joining us. We'll use our time wisely. I'll dive straight in. I'll be referring to some of the verses as well through that story and beyond the story. So it's probably useful just to have a Bible open. Light can illuminate and it can blind. A really powerful light does both. It can show the way, it can light things up, and it can cause difficulty in seeing. It can cause blindness. When our children were quite young, we used to take them off to a big house in the country with another family, and we used to play a game called Colditz. When it was dark, we were a long way from light pollution. We'd take the children, there were five or six of them, sort of into the garden, and take them to the end of the garden. They used to absolutely love the nights we played Colditz. They were all sort of the ages of, I don't know, roughly between 6 and 12. That's the ages that it works well. Not too scared of the dark, but, you know, it's all very exciting being outside. Anyway, they had to get from the end of the garden, which I guess was maybe, I don't know, 100 yards or so from the house, and sort of weave their way through the undergrowth. And I, along with one of the other dads, would stand in the middle of the garden with a torch, a powerful torch, and we'd shine it around the garden. And we were allowed to do it for about 3 or 4 seconds every 30 seconds. And the idea was that we would catch them trying to get from the end of the garden to the house. And you can imagine there was all sorts of fun and antics during that. But anyway, as the light would go on, sometimes that light would absolutely show the path and give them a sort of a shortcut or a route they hadn't otherwise seen. Sometimes the light would catch them directly in their eyes and make it very difficult for them to see for the next 30 seconds or so. And light does that, doesn't it? It can show the way, or it can blind. And if it's powerful enough, it can remove sight altogether. Look at Jesus, verse 5. Look what he says. He describes himself as a light like this. "I am the light of the world," says Jesus. And then glance down just beyond the reading that we had. Verse 39, towards the end of this story, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." In this chapter, Jesus does two things. He gives sight to the blind. He is light to the world, quite literally, unable to see and then seeing. But perhaps a little bit more shockingly, we might say, what we're actually going to see as we go through this chapter is Jesus removing people's sight as well, blinding people. That's going to be our primary subject next week as we look at this chapter in two halves. So let's dive into some of the details. There are a lot of important details, and you'll see the first heading there on the handout, the blind man, a picture of humanity. Look at verse 1 again, back at the start. "As Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, 'Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?'" Now, we know very little about this man. We don't get a name. We don't get many details. We read in verse 8 that he was a beggar. It's understandable. There wouldn't have been many other occupations open to him. The only detail we're really told is that he's blind. But significantly, look at verse 3. Jesus said it wasn't that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. In other words, Jesus is saying this unnamed individual that we know very little about is sort of a vehicle to display the works of God. An example, we might say, an example of what God can do to a broken humanity. I think one other little detail which is worth noting, again, just beyond our reading, look on to verse 14. The healing takes place on the Sabbath. That immediately reminds us, as readers of John's Gospel, of another healing that took place on a Sabbath as well. That was back in chapter 5. Don't bother turning to it. We spent some time there earlier on as we've been going through John. But it's an interesting parallel case. Not a blind guy in that instance, but a guy who'd been paralyzed for 38 years. And so John has given us two Sabbath healings, paralyzed man and a man born blind. And the paralyzed man was severely paralyzed and for 38 years paralyzed. And the guy that's blind was born blind. In other words, we might say what John is showing us and what Jesus specifically picked out were two particularly hopeless cases. These weren't people with minor ailments. These are serious physical setbacks. And like the paralyzed man in chapter 5, the blind man here in chapter 9 functions as much more than just a patient. Here is humanity, we might say, in its natural state, blind from birth. Remember verse 3. Wasn't that he sinned, wasn't that his parents sinned, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. You see, his blindness was not a result of a particular sin of him or his parents any more than it would have been for anyone else. His blindness and the healing were to teach the disciples, were to teach us by extension as readers, something about God. Before we get into the miracle, we need to appreciate what humanity is really like. It's worth just sort of pondering this for a moment. Naturally speaking, we might say, spiritually speaking, blind from birth. And I think that's quite a big thing to get our heads around. I think that we are naturally, collectively, our society is much more optimistic about humanity, about the context in which we find ourselves. But I think the point that we get into by implication here is our friends, our family, our colleagues, unable to help themselves spiritually, just like a man born blind is unable to help himself physically. I think our dangerous group of Christians, perhaps, is forgetting how desperate the world's situation really is. We're surrounded, aren't we, especially in a city like this, by brilliant intellect, high moral standards. I certainly found that after working in and around the West End for 10 years. Very easy to be overly optimistic. Great entrepreneurship. And I think it's very easy to sort of look at some of the achievements, look at some of the incredible individuals, and not see how absolutely desperate their natural spiritual state is. You see, humanity, without Jesus' intervention, is spiritually speaking like the man born blind. And so he doesn't function as an unfortunate exception. He is, if you like, exhibit A of the human condition, blind from birth. But Jesus says we should expect to see the works of God displayed in this individual. It's going to take a miracle, isn't it? For a guy that's never seen before to be able to see, it's going to take some supernatural intervention. And so the stage is set for Jesus to step in. And that brings us to the second point there. Jesus enables the blind to see. Have a look at verse 6 again, because there's some wonderful little details here. Having said these things, he spat on the ground. He made mud with his saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud. A little bit strange, isn't it? The mud and the spit. Lots of sort of speculation as to quite what's going on. And it's worth saying up front, I don't think it's possible to be certain about the interpretation of this. There are a lot of theories. Let me give you some of the ones that are sort of worthy of mentioning, and you know, you can be the judge. I think I've made a call myself, but like I said, we cannot be sure. So here's a little bit of speculation about the significance of mud and saliva. Some think perhaps that saliva has healing properties. I'm not so sure about that myself. Some think that this is Jesus using sort of creation-like symbolism. In the same way that man was made from the dust of the earth, so man is recreated through the mud that's made as the combination of the dust and saliva. You could take that or leave it. I'd suggest the latter. Calvin, great theologian from a bygone era, he suggests that to add mud to a man's eyes makes it even more impressive when you heal him. Well, that's sort of logically true, isn't it? I quite like the simplicity of that. I think there's something a little bit more going on. The whole of the Old Testament has a principle about things being made unclean. It's a very important principle that God's people learn over many, many generations. He requires perfection and holiness. And God's people were plagued all the time with becoming unclean. And of course, something that has been set apart or holy can immediately be made unclean if it comes into contact with something that is not set apart or holy. But Jesus turns that principle on its head. And Jesus alone can transfer a clean status to something that is unclean. And you see that in lots of examples, don't you, where Jesus sort of touches the lepers, or he'll break sort of natural boundaries. So I think maybe what might be going on here is the saliva, a symbol of transfer, something from Jesus to the individual. Like I said, there's a lot of speculation going on there. We can't be sure. Anyway, the point that matters is it works. Look at verse 7. "Go and wash in the pool of Siloam," said Jesus, which means sent. So he went and washed, and he came back seeing. I mean, what a day. Born blind and now seeing. What an incredible turnaround it must have been for that guy. I mean, here he was now seeing a world that he had only ever touched or smelt, perhaps heard about. There's a Christian writer called Max Lucado, and in one of his books, he tells the true story of a guy called Bob Edens. Now, Bob Edens had been blind for 51 years, and the testimony goes, his world was a black hole of sounds and smells, and he felt his way through 5 decades of darkness. Skilled surgeon, performed a very complicated operation, and for the first time, Bob Edens had sight. Listen to his testimony. I love some of the things he says. "I can see the shape of the moon. It's overwhelming," he reports. "And I never would have dreamt that yellow is so yellow. I don't have the words. I'm amazed by yellow." And he goes on. There's lots of other things. But it's just wonderful, isn't it? This idea of having never seen and then seeing. The physical miracle is incredible. I mean, Jesus really could, in our world today, render the NHS totally redundant. I was giving this talk a few weeks ago, and somebody pointed out that the NHS already is redundant, but I think positively redundant if we take it that way. But there's more going on here, much more going on. You see, the real miracle is not the physical sight. As impressive as that is, I don't want to diminish that. That is an incredible thing. But there's something even bigger going on here. And you see that as you sort of carry on reading through the story, which we didn't have time for at the start. You'll see the little subpoint about halfway down the handout there, the physical, spiritual. You see, it is very much a physical healing. But in contrast, direct contrast to the other Sabbath healing in John chapter 5, here there is a spiritual dimension. As we read on in chapter 9, we see that this man's attitude to Jesus changes positively. Just follow it through. If you look at verse 11, you'll see that the man who was healed, describes Jesus just as, well, the man. He is the man called Jesus. I mean, anyone in our world might describe Jesus like that. I should hazard a guess that Professor Richard Dawkins would be quite happy to describe Jesus in that way. Look at verse 17. There's a little bit of progress in his understanding. The once blind man describes Jesus as a prophet. That's more than a man. Small progress. Look on to verse 33. The once blind man now describes Jesus as from God. Again, we might say a sort of relative upgrade. But then look what happens by verse 38 at the end of our story. He accepts Jesus to be not just a prophet, not just somebody from God, but look at the once blind man before Jesus. He says to him, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. That is a very significant thing to do. It means to throw yourself down on the floor and give all of your adoration to an individual, something that should be set apart for God himself. In other words, this guy's converted. I'm sure you've heard of Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. Lewis, of sort of Narnia fame. He's often quoted in different ways. His testimony, his own testimony of his conversion is amazing. You may know that he started off life as an atheist, in his own words, blinded by atheism and rationalism. I mean, he was a brilliant intellect, absolutely sort of above everybody in his fields in terms of sort of literature and understanding. He was encouraged by a number of Christian friends, Roman Catholic friend J.R. Tolkien and a few others. Lots of reading. He made some progress, and he got to a point in his life where he said, well, I'm now a theist. Don't believe in atheism. Now a theist. Not a Christian, but I do believe in some type of God. And then finally, from Lewis's point of view, he reluctantly surrendered and gave in to the Christian God. His testimony you can read in his book, Surprised by Joy. He says, that which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. I gave in, admitted God was God, knelt and prayed, perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. And the point that's being made here in John's gospel, in just the same way that it very obviously takes a physical miracle for the guy's eyes to be opened physically, so it takes a miracle for his spiritual sight to be restored as well. The passage doesn't use the word miracle. It uses instead this phrase, works of God. You remember that in verse 3, that the works of God might be displayed. And so what exactly are the works of God? Well, the works of God mean change of state spiritually. It means belief in God. You see, the work of God is always concerned with the spiritual and with the eternal. And actually, that's a category that Jesus says is much more impressive. He describes it as a greater miracle than the physical stuff. It's not to diminish the physical stuff. It's saying as impressive as a physical healing is, there is something greater, and that is the spiritual work. Now, John goes on to explain over the next few chapters, after chapter 9. I mean, he gathers all the disciples round and he says to them, he commissions them, and he's saying, they're getting worried about Jesus going back to heaven and leaving them. And he says, don't worry, after I've gone, the Holy Spirit's going to come alongside you, help you to remember everything that I've taught you. You're going to write it down and you're going to be witnesses. You're going to take those words out and others will join you. And those words will be the means for the greater spiritual work to take place. I mean, it's wonderful, isn't it, as these words are read and explained. It's why we always get excited about, you know, just hearing the Bible read and explained at a lunchtime. We're doing business with God. This is how spiritual work takes place. More impressive than physical stuff. You see, it's not just intellectual facts. The stuff that's taught when the Bible is opened and explained, or as conversations about Jesus are had in the offices, these are spiritual sort of penny-dropping opportunities. But it means, of course, that for us to understand takes a miracle. It takes Jesus' supernatural intervention. See, it doesn't matter how brilliantly the gospel may be presented or how poorly. Without the words of Jesus being taken by his Spirit and conferred, well, there's no hope. And of course, that is how Jesus' clean status, his holy set-apart status, is conferred on us today, as his word is taught and explained. Jesus, the light of the world, how does that light hit our hearts as his word is taught and brought to life and light? And so what that means is, I mean, you may have been brought along today, or you may have joined us today, having been in the coffee shop perhaps, not completely convinced. We always say our lunchtime talks are for believers and skeptics. We always have skeptics here. If you're sort of thinking, yeah, I'm not really there with Jesus. I get some people are, I'm not there yet. You know, the best thing you could do would be to ask God for help. I don't see it, God. That's a brilliant start. That means you're prepared to accept that there is a bit of blindness, there's a little bit of short-sightedness, we might say, and that you recognize that you need help. Ask God for help. For many of us, of course, who are converted, I mean, of course, this acts as an absolutely essential reminder, doesn't it? Only Jesus can open blind eyes. Only his word can do that. How much do our prayers reflect that? But just in our last few minutes together, this final point you'll see on the handout, I think is a wonderful implication of this. Once we've sort of got the seriousness of the greater work that's taking place, well, spiritual sight changes a person. You see, conversion makes a difference. It's not a little sort of intellectual tick box. Yes, I've done that, right? What else do I do? I'll go off to the gym or something. It's not like that. There's something really deeply profound happens here. It's never a private decision. It's a publicly recognized and verifiable change that's taken place. I mean, that's what happens to our blind guy, now healed. And there's some confusion, even right at the beginning, isn't there? Just look back at verse 8. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but it's like him." And he was there. He kept saying, "I am the man." You can sort of hear the frustration. When God works in us to convert us, people will notice. And this change was profound. I mean, just think about the difference between the start and the end of the story. The start of the story, the guy is blind and begging. As far as society is concerned, he is insignificant, probably at the city gate or whatever, just asking for money. By the end of the story, well, he's head-to-head with the religious authorities, lecturing them. I mean, he's giving them a bit of a diatribe by the end. Just glance down. We'll pick up the story in the middle of his speech to the religious authorities. You imagine a big sort of group of bishops and members of the House of Lords all there. And here this once beggar is now lecturing them. Verse 32, we'll pick it up in the middle. "Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." I mean, that's a big thing to say to the religious establishment. And look at them, their answer in verse 34. "You were born in utter sin, and you would teach us." And they cast him out. What an incredible change from where he'd been. Well, consider the significance of being cast out. That means to be cast out of the synagogue. That means to have a black mark against your name. It would have made it very, very difficult to operate in society. We'll talk more about that next week. But the point here is that spiritual sight changes a person and has a profound impact. That may be something that's happened to you, that you're aware of that sort of change in your own life. Maybe you've been brought along and you've seen that change in the Christian that's brought you along. It makes a big difference when somebody becomes a Christian. It doesn't have no effect. There are lots of examples of this. Think of the Apostle Paul. He tried to kill Christians and succeeded. He was converted. He protected Christians and tried to convert others as an apostle. The story I love the most in this sort of area is the story of Nicky Cruz. There's a couple of books you can read about it, his own testimony and the testimony from the preacher that was involved in his conversion. But Nicky Cruz, he started off, I mean, he's such a serious sort of aggressor, born into a Satanist family. He grew up in one of the most feared gangs in New York, the Mau Mau. It's caused havoc. One day he meets a preacher. The preacher says to him, the preacher's called David Wilkerson. The preacher says, "God loves you." And he said, "I'm going to kill you," because he hated that. 2 weeks later, the preacher had an evangelistic event. Nicky Cruz thought, "Right, I'm going to go and teach him a lesson." And as the story goes, he went armed, ready to cause havoc. As he went to this church, as the mission was going on, Cruz heard the gospel explained. His heart melted. It changed everything. He was converted. Sometime later, he went to Bible school. He became a preacher, and he went back to try and reach the gang that he'd grown up in, the Mau Maus. You see, when God works a miracle in someone, it renders that person unrecognizable. It causes change. And it works, we're out of time, so this is just the final thought. It works not just at an individual level, it works at a macro level too. You want to see change in society, this is how it happens. For all the sort of great ideas about how you change society, they'll never work. That's why nothing ever gets better. But the gospel works, and the gospel causes change. And actually, massive breakthroughs that we've had in sort of social reform, think of the sort of the abolition of slavery, Wilberforce and the Clapham sect, they did huge things to reform society. But the way that they say that those things happened was because of what had happened in the country just before, the spiritual revival of the Great Awakening. Wilberforce is absolutely adamant. That was the only reason that any type of social change had happened in this country. You want to see change in the country? People need to be converted. The gospel is the heart of a complete change. Jesus, the light of the world, he opens the eyes of the blind and he changes people. But there's a second strand. We're going to pick this up next week. He hardens those and brings blindness. That needs to be handled carefully. We'll do that this time next week. Why don't I close in a prayer and I'll hand back to Tom. Heavenly Father, we do thank you so much for your word, and we do pray that we will take seriously these incredible works of Jesus. And we ask this for your glory and for his name's sake. Amen.